Semi-crazy, I think that's less than most. My delusions aren't quite up to snuff. I see the news, a rag soiled with lies. It only gets love when somebody's died. See the cars zip past the crosswalks. Watch you hurry, a wander to the sky. Boring job, one that's gonna kill ya. Turn on, tune in, drop out.
Welcome, one and all, to Professor Metal's irate debate and calamitous commentary with the Philosophical Chain Gang. Today's episode will be Piracy as Civil Disobedience. You may or may not know this about me, but I actually come from a long line of pirates. This is a matter quite dear to mine own heart. My family's been practicing piracy since the early 1500s. Let me just take a moment to interject my own thought. Piracy is indeed a form of civil disobedience. Some of you may already know that piracy was really born of privateers. People who were given leave by their king to go be pirates to other people. Now, what one kingdom would call a privateer, obviously their enemies would refer to as pirates, and this sort of goes back and forth. The English hire privateers, the French hire privateers, the Dutch hire privateers. Everybody has privateers, and everyone else thinks they're pirates. My family pursued a more pure route of piracy, if you will. We would often be privateers for many people at the same time, that way ensuring that we were pirates to all. So let's take a moment to discuss piracy as a form of civil disobedience. Now, one could easily argue that engaging in piracy, you know, robbing somebody else's ship, merchants, passing military fleets and what have you, for your own gain, could be considered merely a criminal act, but I think there was more to it than that. I think what we really have here is a situation wherein gentlemen of modest or low means would oftentimes need to find a way to express their unhappiness with the status quo. To borrow a line, the status was not quo. Oftentimes, through the means of piracy, these gentlemen, again often of modest or very low means, would be able to elevate themselves in a rather stratified society. Back then, there was less mobility from the lower class on up than there is, I don't know, perhaps in France these days? Surely not much less than there is in America. Now, some people may say, but Professor Metal, what these people were doing was criminal. I say nay, they were simply disobeying laws that they felt were unjust. Who was the king, for example, to say, oh, you can't possibly rob these people. They're just humble merchants. Well, of course they're humble merchants. If they weren't humble merchants, they'd have guns. If they had guns, they wouldn't be the target of pirates now, would they? These men were not criminals, as they were often painted, and indeed convicted as if caught. These men were simply saying to the system that they did not agree with the way that things were. They were simply trying to find a better life for themselves and their families. There's nothing criminal about that. Why, if anything, it is the most admirable of goals, to improve one's lot in life and that of future generations. Why, if it weren't for my pirate ancestors, I would never have been able to fund the moon lasers. This fortune has carried us through the centuries. Later on, engaging in airship piracy. That, I'm afraid, was a bit short-lived. You see, Zeppelins never really took off. And I don't know how many of you listening at home have ever tried to rob a jet plane, but let me tell you, it is not an easy task. First off, you have to know exactly where they're going. If you don't, there is no way your Zeppelin will ever catch them. In addition to that, you have to find some way to secure it. Now, there are a great many possibilities in this. The one I liked to go with was grappling hooks. Unfortunately, the first few times we tried this, it didn't work out quite so well. We decided, why not try a helicarrier of some kind? Little did I know, this idea was already taken in Marvel Comics by S.H.I.E.L.D. It turned out that this was a far more expensive process than we thought. After having, you know, gone through product development for the moon lasers and everything, we ran out of money about halfway through. We tried a few other routes. We figured, why not give Zeppelins a go again? But this time, we'll reinforce them. Unfortunately, we realized that the Zeppelins were never going to work out, no matter how much we reinforced them. And thus, we stumbled upon the idea of absconding with the airships, or jets as they're called these days, before they were taken off, starting a new era of what I like to refer to as pre-air piracy. Unfortunately, we realized only later that if we take the plane before people have gotten onto it, there's really no one to rob. And the resale market for jetliners, let me tell you, is not that great. They have all these tracking devices and serial numbers. Is that what they're called, Steve? Yes, serial numbers that keep me from actually moving them to anywhere besides, like, some rogue state. I'm being handed a note here. Thank you, Steve 13. What the hell do you mean that's not what we mean by piracy? What else could we possibly be talking about? Oh, I see. They call themselves pirates, but they're not even in command of a vessel. Is that what you're telling me right now? Minions, now that we have been enlightened as to what we mean by piracy as civil disobedience, please discuss. I would like to take a moment to remind you all that none of us are qualified to give you legal advice as concerns digital piracy. For questions about the legalities of air piracy, you can contact me with the information you'll find in the show notes.
Yeah, I think we're already all on the same page on that one, Professor, but great intro, thanks. We're going to be talking about file sharing, online piracy, with Philosophical Chain Gang. I'm Bruce.
I'm River.
And I'm Sean.
We're discussing piracy as civil disobedience.
Indeed. So, when I say civil disobedience, I mean protest by means of breaking laws considered by the protesters to be unjust in the first place.
I generally agree with this, yes.
Okay.
Valid working definition.
Okay, alright. So we can move on from there. Excellent.
Yes.
If piracy is viewed as civil disobedience, then it seems like the law to which it refers is going to clearly be intellectual property law, right? Mm-hmm. So, what are some basic reasons why someone might need to protest intellectual property law? I mean, isn't that working like a charm for everyone everywhere?
I definitely think there's some contention about intellectual property law and how it does or honestly does not work in our current system, and some would suggest that a lot of companies and intellectual property holders are overstepping their bounds in what they do to enforce that law.
But isn't that almost an unavoidable evil produced by the way that intellectual property law is enforced? I mean, a copyright holder is required to police their own copyright, so won't somebody inevitably take the next step in an attempt to police and patrol their copyright until someone tells them you can't do that?
I think that's the problem, is nobody's told them you can't do that yet, even though they have done some somewhat despicable things. For example, when RIA, the Recording Industry Association of America, sued the creators of LimeWire for intellectual property loss at a individual rate for each individual file in their system, the total amount they sued them for was more money than existed on the planet Earth.
Okay, so that seems clearly abusive. How could anyone possibly pay an amount of money that had not been created as of that time, let alone any given individual who clearly did not have all of that money, or company, in the case of OneWare. but, you know, I think the response to that would be that that practice has stopped. That those kinds of lawsuits have ended because even the RIAA acknowledged that that was unreasonable.
But I think a lot of the reason that these the status quo middlemen have changed their business models, relaxed them somewhat, or relaxed their approach to privacy or to piracy, is because piracy continues to be pervasive despite those efforts. So if we view it as something that is changing the response to it, then you've got to say, as a form of civil disobedience, maybe it's working.
I agree that they are changing the way they approach it. I do not believe they are letting off, though.
Not entirely, but I will say the responses are kind of all over the map. You've still got the hardliners, but you've also got a lot of content middlemen who their response to it is to not so much be tough, but let's lower the bar of entry for them to do it legally. And whereas most people would prefer to do it legally if they can afford to and it's convenient. But then again, like I say, it's all over the map. You've got some of them who are really responding to piracy in the same way of saying, well, let's compete with it. And then we've got people who are saying, well, let's crack down on it. And now, I mean, where we're at right now in 2015, it's just spread all over the place from one end to the other. 5 years ago, those industries were pretty lockstep in how they responded to this.
That's fair, but we've been seeing a lot more, I guess, petty crackdowns on music sharing and certain other information sharing. Things like coffee shops and other public spaces being sent cease and desist because they didn't own the license or didn't have the right to play a song over their PA system.
Absolutely.
Which Rhea has been doing in some cases. The fact that there are licenses you can buy through certain companies to play music, where one version requires you to write down all of the information of every song or video you play, where another one that costs slightly more doesn't. And at that point you wonder, how are they tracking that?
A lot of the business models that exist, the classic business models, they don't really work, and it's causing a lot of that conflict. And I think that's the thing that makes certain amounts of piracy valid, is because there are response to models that don't work, and they create a climate in which there's a lot of people, and the RIAA are kind of hardliners on this, but in which a lot of people need to try to do things differently, come up with different models. I think the RIAA will probably hold out as long as they can, but they're going to be one of the last bastions to crumble. I admit there are still hardliners out there, and a lot of what they do is extremely petty.
That brings up another point I was going to make. A lot of these companies have started going after internet service providers instead of individuals to try and throttle or limit access to the internet in general of those people that they perceive as pirating, who, as I understand it, have a legal right to digital copies of their media because they own a physical copy. This has been referenced a lot before in early piracy indictments of, like, people making digital backups of CDs and certain videos to their computers.
I think within Comcast in particular, there's an interesting example, because for Comcast, at one point, they had no skin in the game of where the content came from. And at that point, we actually saw a whole lot of consumer protection around whether or not they would respond to subpoenas, whether or not they would provide information to agencies like the RIAA who were attempting to ascertain pirating or were attempting to bring pirating lawsuits. But as soon as Comcast got some skin in the game during the NBC Universal Vivendi Comcast conglomeration that eventually turned into the company Comcast is now, there was suddenly a sea change. There was a value to Comcast as an internet service provider to also be policing that content because they were content holders, content owners in another section. So now, whereas the original conditions had been favorable to protecting users because they were the income source, now the income source had changed and it became valuable to go after these people in their own right. And that was, to a large extent, when you started to see a lot of cease and desist letters come up, specifically about content that Comcast now had some ownership stake in. So I think that at least on some tertiary level, you can say that part of the civil disobedience is in that companies are allowed to play by a different set of rules than the individuals involved are. Whereas an individual might have previously given their money to a company that they felt comfortable with because they seemed to be defending a principle that they felt comfortable having defended by that company, that sea change happened in a very short period of time and left that person in the opposite position. Something that seems, at least feels, perhaps is the best word, like a bit of a betrayal.
Yeah, it used to be that the mergers would sometimes get declined. Now, every time you hear a merger is being considered, I've never heard one being refused.
I think the last time I heard about one being refused was the AT&T T-Mobile merger. Although I'm not sure how relevant that is to this in particular. But I think there's definitely been a decline of antitrust and large company conflict of interest considerations going on at the regulatory level in the last, say, 10 years.
True. And also we've seen some unfortunately shady tactics being used on companies that aren't hardline or aren't cracking down on piracy or file sharing like Google. Some of the recently released Sony documents have pointed to a sort of conspiracy between the MPAA and numerous large media corporations about trying to take out Google, as it were, or trying to get them on their side to make Google comply more, which they've had a history of not really wanting to, but having to because of certain, as I understand them, legal reasons.
I think there's a fair point to be had there because there have been cases of collusion between companies in these kinds of positions against the people at the bottom of the food chain in terms of media markets. I think that there are a lot of shady practices around intellectual property in general, and that there are probably reasons to protest against the current legislative situation of them. But I want to refocus us a little bit on, now that we've sort of extolled what one might be protesting, let's come back to the question of, is this a valid means of protest with regard to that?
Let me just stop you right there. Might I just say that there's no way that any collusion between corporations could possibly bring down Google. I once thought about making that mine own mission statement, and then I realized something very important. That one day Skynet will be powered by Google, and I have no desire to displease my future robot overlords.
That collusion against Google, and it's in the same piece of them going against torrent tracker sites, which is that it has become standard practice for opponents of piracy to go after someone who is technically only being a third-party broker. So this does raise an interesting philosophical, ethical question. Let's say somebody steals something, and they go to someone who knows who might buy such things. And he asks for an address, and that person says, well, yes, if you go to this address, you'll find somebody who's likely to be able to purchase, hypothetically, assuming that you have this golden candelabra, that you might find a buyer there. And that person goes there and he buys it. Now, is this person who all they did was give the information of where the buyer of the stolen property might live, is he liable for theft, in a sense?
Is he liable for
theft? Is he committing a crime?
I think that you could make a good case for collaborators in a crime are themselves guilty of a crime. I'm not sure they're guilty of the original crime.
Well, see, I think LimeWire made the mistake in that the data was actually passing through their servers. Now, in a torrent system, all they're doing is giving you a tracker. See, hypothetically, if you had stolen a candelabra, hypothetically, if you went to this address, you might find somebody who would purchase such an item. Has this person committed a crime? That's all the Pirate Bay does.
I have a problem with your analogy.
Okay.
because we are talking about two very different things. One thing is a physical object that has material worth, and the other is a non-physical object that can be potentially copied an infinite number of times.
Agreed.
Even if we allow that the uploader is committing a crime by sending a copy of something, and actually, as I understand it, uploading is what's illegal, downloading isn't. But of course, when you see torrents, you're doing both. You know, when you hold the Pirate Bay, or even Google for that matter, accountable for giving information on connecting two other people to transfer files, and the file isn't being transferred through your system, how do they then hold you responsible for the crime? Because that's what they are doing.
Well, but it's not quite analogous, is it? I mean, because you're not just telling somebody where to go to find someone who does this, you're introducing them to that person. Like, it's more like you went and said, hey, this is Jimmy. Jimmy might or might not be able to buy that thing you might or might not have stolen. In which case, there's a level of tacit understanding of what's going on that's not present in, boy, I hear down by the docks there are a lot of people who do stuff like that.
Well, the other thing is that the gold candelabra might or might not have been stolen, or it might have been, it might be your indie band that you have rights to that you're sharing the file with.
I think that, again, just to take it in it purely without ramification elsewhere, just as displayed in your analogy, I think that maybe there is a case to be had that there's a crime of which the party making the connection is guilty, but that it isn't the initial crime. It's not the same crime that the person who... Let's say for a second that it is a stolen candelabra, okay? And then somebody along the way is caught, and this is all being litigated, because otherwise this analogy sort of falls apart. Thus, the person who is being interrogated regarding their role in directing the person to either an individual or a place, depending on which you feel is the more appropriate metaphor, that person may have committed a crime, but has not stolen the candelabra, right? So...
Nor bought it,
yeah. That person may have facilitated doing so, though. And I think the question there becomes, can you show whether or not that person had knowledge that it was stolen at the time? That's where it gets a little bit trickier when you start trying to change the analogy back into a website. It seems like maybe something's broken down there, because if the website can't have knowledge, it seems like it is therefore necessarily not guilty, even if it was used in the commission of a crime.
As a point of clarification, are we just talking about the website as its own entity, or the website and the administrators, webmasters, moderators of that website?
I think it has to be the website and its administrators and whatnot, now that I think about it. Because if it's just the website itself, then the website can have no intention whatsoever, which is actually more important than whether or not it can have knowledge. Because in most cases, regarding whether or not someone can be an accomplice to a crime, they have to have had the intention to be an accomplice to a crime. A person who is an unwitting accomplice is generally not liable for their role as an accomplice. If I walk into a bank and some guy says, here, hold my bag, and I go, oh, okay, and he goes, ha ha, there's a bomb in there, you're a bank robber now, I'm generally not held accountable for the robbery of the bank. On the other hand, if I walk in knowing there's a bomb in the bag, I've now become an accomplice to the robbery of the bank. Which brings up an interesting problem in its own right. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which has its own set of detractors and supporters, says that a website that handles user-uploaded content isn't held accountable for the content that's uploaded so long as the administrators make a good faith effort to prevent that content from being violational of some other law. We see this in YouTube, where DMCA takedown notices are the system by which they remove content that is otherwise infringing, but YouTube itself is not held accountable for the uploading of copyrighted content. The problem becomes whether or not the website was set up with the specific intention of facilitating an otherwise illegal activity. And then you're into intentionality. Since the website can't have intentionality, I think it has to be the administrators and creators thereof who could have intentionality for it to be a viable question to ask.
So we've got to ask ourselves, you know, what, well, privacy of thought again. We don't know what their intentions are. If we look at their behavior, their public statements, what they go on, administrator of ISO Hunt, the people in the Pirate Bay, typically they've got actually quite a bit of stuff on records saying that they're doing this for purposes of civil disobedience. But let's go to that point that you touched on, River. You mentioned the fact that it's something being copied, not something being taken. Nothing's actually being stolen in the sense of, well, now you don't have it. Another significant difference between online piracy and high seas piracy, which is why the term piracy is a bit inflated. The only thing they're really losing is opportunity cost. If we assume that everyone who grabbed a copy of this would have paid full retail price for it, that's where we get these crazy kinds of numbers.
And I think with that, we run into another type of problem. Is everyone who pirates something going to pay retail or even a discounted price if it is unavailable for nominally free on the internet?
That's actually a maximum limit of how much money they could make.
Right.
So, obviously, just statistically, they couldn't approach that.
I think the infinite reproducibility of goods raises an interesting philosophical question, in that if we assume a person owes a share of the total amount of money that the company should have made from that product for having a copy of that product, as opposed to assuming that you owe, say, $39.95 for your copy of Bob's Magic Handbook, or whatever other piece of media one had, then it would seem to suggest that one owes an infinitesimally small percentage of the total revenue that should have been produced by that. So, should intellectual property rights be migrated to a concept of imaginary property rights?
Well, it certainly doesn't cost the content creators anything more for me to send you a copy of what I bought from them.
Sure.
It doesn't even cost anything off of their server hosting space. Again, the only thing they're losing out is an opportunity cost. On the one hand, they'd probably like money from some of the people who would be pirating it, and if the rest of them can just do without, I imagine is how they view it. However, I think in some cases, piracy actually, by increasing the overall number of people who have this media, or, you know, are interested in it, get access to it, or fans of it, I think to some extent that actually does increase the number of people who buy it.
I think you have a very fair point there, using Game of Thrones as a reference on that. It is the most pirated show on the internet. It's also one of the highest selling DVDs on the market. So one would have to think that at least part of those sales came from people who downloaded illegally, or legally for that matter, a copy of the show they later decided to go out and buy it on DVD. And as a matter of fact, it seems like more than just as an assumption that HBO is banking on that particular strategy as a way to hype this show up.
And initially, actually, the CEO of HBO had come out and said some things when he talked about it being the most pirated. He said, well, that's a really great compliment. Later on, after some people had talked to him, he reversed himself, well, piracy is wrong, and so forth. But another thing he said is, well, they've been dealing with the issue of people stealing their stuff for decades, back in the 80s, you know, the person running a split of the cable out of their neighbor's house. So they aren't terribly concerned over it.
And there are certainly some other approaches to dealing with piracy that have come out. A lot of various media have counted on a pirate culture to carry an otherwise fairly low distribution product out to a much wider audience, and then hope that that comes back in the form of more sales than they would have gotten out of their small distribution release. As to whether or not that's been successful, I think we'd have to talk on a case-by-case basis, and I'm not sure that I'm prepared with the kind of information I would need to have for that. But it seems like a perfectly viable strategy.
We're seeing a lot of media given away for next to nothing or nothing, and they seem to be doing just fine.
Well, that's actually kind of interesting, because we have seen cases of that happening in the video games market. Two notable examples are the game No Time to Explain, in which the creators released a copy on the Pirate Bay that, in all ways, like the original, but instead of having a changeable hat system, which was a feature of the game, your character would always wear a pirate hat and eye patch, which was kind of a send-up to the whole piracy thing. Another example is Game Dev Tycoon, a somewhat popular simulation game where you play a small-time game developer as they kind of go through the years. And they released a version on the Pirate Bay. Ironically, in the code, after a certain point in the game, your sales would fall off because of piracy, which was both a sort of, hey, here's a demo of our game, and also a take that to internet pirates.
I think that there are a lot of interesting strategies out there, and that we're developing new ways to deal with this that don't have to be as confrontational as the past of the RIAA and the MPAA have been in society.
Something I pointed at, you know, when we started here was that, you know, because, I think because of the prevalence of piracy, what the industries were initially very much combative and in lockstep, and since then have sort of gone all over the map trying different strategies to deal with it, some of which are, and they do need a new strategy. I don't think the previous model was supportive even without piracy.
So it sounds like so far what we've come to is that piracy could be a form of civil disobedience, and that as a form of civil disobedience, it might be appropriate given what's gone on in that industry, in some cases at the very least. But I think we need to deal with the outlying case at that point. When would it not be appropriate? If piracy is an acceptable form of civil disobedience, what about, say, actually stealing things?
I feel that there's a line there at the point in which someone trying to commit civil disobedience intrudes upon someone's bodily autonomy in the form of violence or personal space breaching or whatever, what have you. I feel that that is certain, at least a fairly hard line in which really shouldn't be crossed, in which it goes from a potentially right thing to a wrong thing.
So the breaching of personal space with regards to an individual is what you're talking about.
Yes.
Why wouldn't that apply to a company? Let's take, for example, protesters who break into labs and release lab animals.
They seem to think that the situation is dire enough to necessitate such action. I think that might be going too far, because when I think of the ones that are okay, all that's really being harmed is something abstract, whether it's opportunity cost, or if we think of, for example, the civil rights sit-ins, they're just really taking up space, preventing business from being done. Again, opportunity cost. Other sit-ins during the 60s are in the way and preventing things from, again, opportunity cost. There's only an abstract thing that's being harmed or lost. There's no harm to either real persons or real property.
I think that might be a very fair line to draw, that real persons and real property are somehow separated from the notion of civil disobedience, because it is no longer about the unjust law, but instead about the possession or the person who is being harmed.
If all that is lost is something that is potential.
I can definitely agree with that, yeah.
It's harder to make the case that it is truly loss, that you've actually taken anything.
So maybe you could talk a little bit more about that. Why is a loss of potential not the same as a loss of the actual?
Oh, well, because one's real and one isn't.
Well, yeah.
However, businesses treat these as the same. They'll put opportunity costs on a ledger, and any, you know, executive worth his salt is going to look at opportunity costs as a cost.
Okay. But why should or shouldn't one consider opportunity cost a real cost?
If we defined harm in such a way as to include all prevention of potential, it'd be almost impossible to define, or to determine in many cases, whether something is harm. Now there actually are some cases where we actually do that. Like, for example, if a company is liable for some horrible injury that happens to me that prevents me from pursuing my career, I can claim damages about my future job loss. But I've got to show pretty consistently that I would have that. But in more general terms, if we say, well, you know what, I would have won the lottery if it wasn't for what you did. You told me this was my lucky number and I used it. I would have won the lottery if I hadn't picked that number. I would have picked the one that not won. You know what I mean? It'd be completely open-ended. We could say anything is harm.
So there's some sense of reasonable harm, if you will?
Yeah, real harm. Harm to real things.
Well, I don't think we can use real because you've already outlined a case in which real harm does not occur and yet we still acknowledge it. I mean, a reasonable harm, something that a reasonable person would go, yeah, you were probably harmed by that. Admittedly, is not a terribly well-defined standard, but certainly within the law is something that has been relied on before.
And I suppose if the RAA could make a very strong, very clear case that they would have made X dollars if it weren't for piracy, and X isn't some ridiculous number, and they can show that going forward they would have made this if it weren't for piracy, they might have a stronger case to make. But in every case, they've just gone kind of nuts with it.
Bruce, silence! River, I give you the last word.
Well, thank you, Professor. I definitely feel that this is a topic very important to a lot of people because of how contentious it is and how many opinions there are and what's going on and how it's kind of affected a lot of people's livelihoods, especially in the litigation sense. And there's actually some people trying to do something about that. There's a church that is recognized by the Swedish government that cropped up recently called the Church of Compimism, or the Missionary Church of Compimism, that believes strongly that copying data and information, not necessarily intellectual properties, but all data and information, is very important. Not only is something you should do, but is ethically right to them to do. And it's very interesting that it's affected people in such a way as to make it a creed for them, that there is so much importance on information, especially digital information and data and what we experience in a non-real, mostly abstract, constructed place like the internet and computer systems, that they consider it sacred. They also believe, of course, that the creation of data is sacred and that mixing old data with new data is a good thing and ethically right. It's really interesting that we see a government, especially one like Sweden, who has been cracking down on piracy lately, that is respecting their religious beliefs. And I think that we're going to see a lot more philosophical and semi-spiritual people as the internet and computers become a lot more pervasive in the first world, become more and more a part of our daily lives as we are more connected with our smartphones, our computers, our tablets, any number of electronic devices. There are a lot of people who feel that information should be free, even if it is created for someone for monetary value, to be sold. People who have copyrights and other intellectual property protected by law aren't necessarily okay with this, obviously, because it is considered a form of piracy, but one man's piracy might be another man's ethical duty. They may feel it is a necessary thing for them to do as a member of the internet, as it were, that they not only can, but should necessarily do this thing, because they feel that this information is made more important by the more people who know it, and the more people who are exposed to it. Other than the sort of philosophical aspect of, or the spiritual aspect of copying information so that it can be disseminated because of the feeling of ethical goodness, another reason people might do it as a form of social disobedience is because we are generally considered to live in a capitalist system. Because of that, distributing things what ought to be sold could be seen as a subversion of the capitalist model, or it could be seen as a breakdown of the system. So you see two reasons why someone would want to do that. Putting it out there, they are not only displeasing, but kind of going against this system we've built up of who owns what, and who has the right to own what, and who should own what. If you put something out on the internet to be a free thing, that I wouldn't say necessarily takes away its value. It might take away some monetary value of it because of potential for profit or anticipated cost, what have you. But it makes it more valuable in that there are more people who it is available to, who can benefit from it. And I personally feel that that is far more important, is putting something out there that makes somebody's life better freely as opposed to charging for them is that somebody couldn't afford otherwise. I don't see that as being a bad action, even if it is considered by some a form of theft, even though there's no real actual loss.
This has been Professor Metal's Irate Debate and Calamitous Commentary with the Philosophical Chain Gang. Join us next time after we get the plasma control units back online. I've been your host, Professor Metal.
I'm Sean.
I'm River.
I'm Bruce.
And we're all in terrible danger.
Security, slavery, it's better than the dark.